The Urbanist is brought to you in association with the Department of Culture and Tourism, Abu Dhabi. Saadiyat Cultural District, Abu Dhabi, is a beacon of hope and inspiration. A catalyst to spark growth and collaboration with museums and experiences, where art and science and nature and technology coexist.
The belief of Abu Dhabi that culture is the backbone of our society.
Stay tuned for a special episode of the show, in which you can hear His Excellency Mohammed Khalifa Al Mubarak explain exactly why and how Saadiyat Cultural District Abu Dhabi is the perfect place to collaborate, create and innovate. Saadiyat Cultural District Abu Dhabi, proud partner of The Urbanist on Monocle Radio.
Hello and welcome to Monocle 24's The Urbanist, the show all about the cities we live in. I'm Andrew Tuck. Coming up on this week's programme.
I think the importance of the public realm to make it with very high quality, and that is inclusive and for everybody. And by that, I think diversity is quite important.
That was the architect Monica von Schmalensee, who we first met last week as part of a two-episode look at the role that private developers play in cities. And in this episode, she's joined again by developer Jared Della Valle and the urban planner Alfredo Caraballo. It's a sparky debate. Plus, we take a closer look at the new World Trade Center, right here on The Urbanist with me, Andrew Tuck. So welcome to this week's programme. The Van Allen International Council hopes to foster sharing between some of the world's leading architects and city makers. And last week we heard how their tour of London was a trigger point for a debate about public-private partnerships and developments, a key flashpoint for all city makers. Visits to two projects in London, the King's Cross redevelopment and Queen Elizabeth Olympic Park, provided a starting point for the people on the Van Allen bus to share their professional experiences working on similar projects across the globe. One such development is Hudson Yards, a $25 billion project in New York. And this is where we pick up our conversation from last week with our guests Monica, Jared and Alfredo. I started by talking to Jared about his involvement in two projects, Hudson Yards and the High Line, both headline-grabbing developments, one regularly lambasted and the other mostly heaped with praise. I ask him how he feels about them now, looking back to those headlines and all the work, and whether the criticism was justified or not. Here he is.
I think there's a great discrepancy between Hudson Yards and something like King's Cross. Hudson Yards, in every respect, feels like it is not for New Yorkers. Maybe people felt that way about Rockefeller Center when it was built, but to a degree, everything has a gloss to it and a newness, and there's no patina, right? There's no existing context with which to be found. And even the High Line in and of itself, which should be sort of the great relic, you end up queuing on the High Line to dump into the space where the Heatherwick Vessel is, and everything about it speaks to a transient population. Nothing about it speaks to the permanence of that particular place. Perhaps with time, that will work, but the architectural tools there are very different than they are in a place like King's Cross.
And when you talk about this proximity of buildings and this intimacy, that seems to have been something that wasn't so much at the forefront, for example, in Hudson Yards.
I don't think it was. Part of the challenge with Hudson Yards is the immediacy of it, right? The true success from a developer's perspective is that Hudson Yards happened relatively overnight for that many square feet. And the assertiveness with which Related was able to achieve that development is truly remarkable. The question is our city better for it? And that answer is, it seems to be no from the general perspective of the public. They took a lot of risk off of the table. The fact that they built that within one development cycle is remarkable.
Alfredo, in a way, that sums up why this debate is so important, why the things that you're seeing here over the last few days are so relevant for our listeners, because, you know, the way that the city integrates with these new projects is really important. A really interesting point there, you know, if you're building something from scratch And you know, you don't have the benefit of some nice warehouses to convert and the canal running through the centre of the plot. You've got just a big flat plot of land to start building on. Is that much more difficult to make a place that people love across time?
The short answer is yes, but everything was new once. One of my favorite architects called Rafael Moneo says that duty of the architect when you have a strong context is to respond to it. But when the context is weak or non-existent, we create the surrogate context for the place to come. And in a sense, there is also no such a thing as an empty space. There is always something that then you can learn from it and use to your own advantages. In the case of King's Cross, now seems easy that there were these amazing historical buildings there. There were three previous attempts to do a master plan, to do a place there, and things didn't fall into places. And actually, these things that right now we see as character were huge obstacles for development in the past. So obviously, circumstances change. And in the case of the Olympics, then obviously we have a different thing, different conditions. It's a larger project. There was a completely different agenda in relation to the east of London. We had a very good deadline that we couldn't miss in the form of 2012, which is really good to have a strong deadlines like that. The objectives of the project are slightly different. And the creation of this Olympic Park has been an extraordinary achievement. The largest new park that has been created in London for more than 100 years.
Monica, let's bring you in here. You went across to the park. And again, maybe you could start by giving us your take on what you saw and the success of the project and anything that maybe you thought was actually a challenge still to be resolved there even.
Yes, I think both King's Cross and also the Olympic, it has the water very close to it and also the green park and also how that's used. But what's very impressive was also the possibility to have this new culture, different institutions coming into this area. We talked a lot about it today as well. We could also see that all the spaces between the buildings could be perhaps better developed, but there is a very big chance this will be for Londoners and not for visitors as much as, I mean, the Olympic Games from the beginning was for all the visitors. But now there is a fantastic possibility to have a really nice recreational area. And maybe it has to be more programmed. And in the beginning, it seemed to be more temporary or kinds of allotments, and you could have gardeners and things. So I think it could be perhaps better programmed, so there will be for all ages and more things happening within these green areas. But I was also very impressed by all the sports facilities and all the new schools that are in the area, which will populate it and also make it more livable. Altogether, I think that it's a lot of things that we can learn from this kind of really, really big project. I mean, we went to the Bartlett School, and that was the, you know, former media center, and how these kind of buildings can be transformed into something totally different. So altogether, I would say I was, you know, really impressed.
Londoners are very hard on their city, and you know, everyone's hard on their own city about what it does and delivers. But Monica, coming from a Nordic background, knowing so much of what's done there around development, which always seems to be a little bit more to outsiders, a little bit more inclusive and a little bit more contained in its aspirations about making money for people. Does London seem like a good laboratory for these projects?
The thing is, now I think we have to look at London more than we used to do before, which is kind of interesting, though, because how do we have this long-term engagement? Even politics, they are in a very short term when they are elected. But it seems like this long-term lease, the long-term engagement, even for the public here, and also how and why the private engagements is also very important to do that. So I think there are also something about the content of this area as well as the context, which sometimes in Sweden we don't talk so much about that, which we should do, actually, I think. To be attractive is good placemaking if you take into consideration that it is for everybody. So I think we could also learn a lot from London, as we talked about before, but it has to do with the competence of planning, but also to work more interdisciplinary and to use that as a big asset, really.
Jared, when you went around the Olympic Park and in general in London, did it change your opinions about anything? Were there ideas that you think you want to go back and chew over when you return stateside?
It was a remarkable experience for me. I think these types of projects are rare and they require real vision. And it's interesting to see projects of scale happening like this simultaneously, and why perhaps London was more successful in its achievements than New York was. I think there's a lot to learn from the process and from the thoughtfulness of the work that's been done. But there's also for us in New York a rarity of sites of scale like this. They just, land is so scarce in New York to create opportunities like this. Actually, you can almost not think of another one that could happen.
And on this tension between the role of the public part and the private part, do you see that changing going forward? You know, we've talked about some of these projects that are successful and not successful, but certainly there's always been a vocal public, but it seems that more and more people are finding their kind of inner Jane Jacobs, and they're kind of determined to have a say about their city, and that people are organising and they are better at realising what the outcomes could be because there's been so many projects and things. Do you think that the whole debate around this is going to shift a little bit?
No, actually, the tension is really valuable. People have a voice now in a way that they never have before. And the immediacy of communication in so many forms enables people who are typically not inclined to comment. It gives them a forum, which is valuable. The role of private developers functioning in the public sphere is becoming more important. And the arguments for why people are frustrated by the process is pretty clear in a lot of cases, because people are frustrated that their tax dollars are not achieving the benefits that they are sacrificing, as it were, from their paychecks. Why isn't the infrastructure happening in the way? Why can't the city function, build more transportation, as an example, or more public schools? And so these issues and the nuances behind people's frustration with development is valuable for both government to hear and for the development community to hear. As a developer myself, I'm often cast as the villain, as the conversation this last couple of days, I think I was called a carnivore and, you know, a handful of other things, not directed at me, but it was the whole reason as an architect I became a developer was to control the outcome, to be able to define program and the priorities of what the value set of an architect can bring to the built environment, which is different than that a developer in and of themselves can. We pursue the alternative use of the word value. And I think that's what we're hearing in general, which is the role of the developer is important to make vital cities. And the question is, who is the visionary? Who has that responsibility? In the instance of Argent, they clearly had a visionary leader and they did a remarkable job in shepherding the process through, and they have a vision that's very long term. In the case of the Olympic sites, the city's vision was to recoup its investment quickly after investing in the Olympic site itself, which leaves it to individual developers after the fact, which leaves a gap to a degree in who the visionary is for that going forward. So the outcomes are different.
Now, I saw Monica scribbling away. I don't think it was when you said the word carnivore. I don't think she was writing carnivore on her notepad. Monica, what was your feeling about where the debate should go?
I'm not sure exactly where the debate should be, but when we talked about this opportunities that was given, I think that was quite interesting. I mean, there is an opportunity. In this case, it was around the Olympics where it was possible to create these cultural institutions. And suddenly that became something that it was not only a destination, but it culture and the art and everything else that will kind of, you know, drive the shaping of the area and also cities forward. I think that's interesting to talk about. But one thing that we did not mention yet, which I think was also part of this, was the sustainability and the how they have worked with that, and also around the Olympics, where that could be more visible and it could be more of a part of the future. So that was something that I was thinking a lot about while walking there, and also there were still so many cars in the area, which is something, I mean, in the future, I think it should be more walkable and cyclable and another way to get around.
Sustainability is such a difficult word because I never quite know what people mean. Everyone seems to have a different version of what sustainable is. And is sustainability reusing old buildings, or is it the mobility question, how we get around? But, you know, the bit that I'm trying to get hold of here, I guess, Alfredo, is like, It feels to me that Londoners have quite an opinion now about what they want to happen in their city. They've watched from afar all sorts of developments that have not served their needs in any way. And they have some good now examples of they can see what you need when it goes right. Do you feel that debate in the decisions that you make? Are you feeling the pressure to raise the bar a little bit?
Which is a good thing.
Yes.
And in a sense, that tension between the public and the private sector, the tension with the community, the voice that the community have in all this debate is also fundamental, because I think that the private sector has an enormous responsibility and a fundamental role in city making, as we are saying, but needs to be in check at the same time in relation to the public good. What is at the end of the day when time passes, because these are very, very young places that needs to grow, needs to mature, needs to change and adapt to things that are coming in the future, like, well, the future of mobility or the future of retail. And so these places are going to change and adapt. And at the same time, I feel that in several of these places, few things, very small things have happened that incorporate the communities and change the way in which people around these places live. You can take your son or your daughter to swim in the Olympic pool, pay £5, and swim in that incredible facility. That's absolutely remarkable. Or you can, from whatever community you are around King's Cross, go to Granary Square and play with the water jet, and you don't have to buy anything, and then has opened up an edge towards the Regent's Canal. That couldn't have happened 25 years ago. These are gains for London as a city that will last.
I'm going to ask you all for some conclusions from the days you've had here, maybe something that's your best takeaway from the good things you've seen, but also maybe what you think your job is in this debate going forward. Jared, you said you've been called a carnivore. That seems a bit mean. You had the vegetarian sandwich, didn't you?
Deliberately.
Surely, yeah, I'm often intrigued. If I was a developer, you have kind of the best job in the world. You have an ability to leave legacy for generations to come, that people look up at building, they're like, okay, Jared, Alloy, that's their work. And I think the best developers seem who aren't being pressured to do value engineering at every turn, they do care about what they leave. So perhaps we can start with you. What do you think your job is in this debate about delivering private spaces which work for an entire city? And maybe what was the one top of mind takeaway that you'd have had from the last few days?
I think my job is to be a reliable partner. Yeah, the development community is generally untrustworthy. And I think that reliability is really valuable, which means we need to enable enough process where we can really listen. Ultimately, being the architect and developer, I'm clientless, which makes the city my client, right? Which means that there's a different sense of responsibility that comes along with the work that we produce. And ultimately, it's the guiding force behind our practice. More than ever, I think you can witness, and I think the difference between the two projects sort of shows the intention of ownership over the long term. I think for us, and my own takeaway is that participating over the future life of a building or a community, being a reliable partner, being part of the neighborhood, and being a member of the community is exceptionally valuable. Wanting to have the freedom and control to do that, which is a tall order. Economics don't always provide for that. But to me, that is one of the biggest takeaways from here. It's really visible when someone has the intention of participating over the long term.
Alfredo, the same question for you. What's your job in this important debate? And after these days on the Van Allen bus, as it were, what's your takeaway?
First, on our role, like, I think architects, we are, in a sense, the referee. There's sort of a piece in between different demands, the demand of the developer, the demands of the local authorities and planners, the demands of the users and the community. We need to, in a sense, absorb and understand sometimes these contradictory demands and give shape to the place in such a way that, in a sense, we try to solve as much as possible some of the contradictions, but create places that are inclusive and that are for everyone. Most of the time, incredibly difficult. We don't always succeed, but in the moments that we do it, then, well, great places and great cities happen. Probably the thing that I took, leaving aside the debates that we have that were incredibly enriching, for me is historical perspective of these issues that we are discussing in relation to the private sector doing city making. Because in a sense, when we started with the great estates of the Bedford Estates and Grosvenor in central London that have been doing city making for 300 years, then we analyze and see some examples for the 20th century. We ended up in two recent projects of the 21st century in London. And in a sense, once we start understanding that the life of places is very, very long, we might be maybe a little bit patient with our young places that we are just started creating. Maybe these places that are still in their teen years will mature into grown-up places further down the line.
Monica, your role in this debate, apart from asking often very good questions, I've bumped into Monica across the years and she's always got a good question, but asking you the questions this time, what's your role? And after, again, these days with, you know, developers and planners and thinkers around this topic, what's the thing you're putting in your pocket to take away?
One word that's coming into my mind is diversity, which I think is quite important in the public realm, but also the importance to guard and to really protect the public realm and also the spaces between the buildings. I can see more and more the importance of the public realm, and especially, you know, in this year when we are so connected and we are so digital, and it seems like the face-to-face meeting is even more important than ever before. So I think the importance of the public realm to make it with very high quality, and that is, as Alfredo said, inclusive and for everybody. And by that, I think diversity is quite important, different ages, so we can meet. But I have a good faith. I think that we have just started this discussion about this, and I think in the future it will not be so much about, you know, what the buildings look like rather than what the environment can make for those that are there.
Monica von Schmalensee, a senior partner and architect at White Architecture, Jared Della Valle, co-founder of Alloy Development, and Alfredo Caraballo, a partner at Allies and Morrison. Thank you all for joining me here on The Urbanist. Now, this tour by the Van Allen Institute and their guests in London provided the opportunity to discuss similar projects in other parts of the world. One of those was New York's World Trade Center. The site was master planned by Studio Libeskind, who worked closely with community and business stakeholders to balance the memory of the 9/11 tragedy with the need for a lively neighbourhood and commercial centre. Monocle's Nick Manise sat down with Carla Swickerath, a partner at Studio Libeskind and board member of Van Allen, to find out more about how the relationship between community, government and business interests played out in Manhattan.
We work on a lot of very large projects all around the world, so we've seen a lot of different constitutions where public and private systems get together to do something that's for the greater good, right? It can work that way. If that's from the World Trade Center that we did the master plan for, which is, you know, probably the one of the largest examples of a project we worked on that had a public-private relationship, but also a project we did, the Docklands in Dublin, which was a public-private partnership, which was a theater and offices. So I think to do some of these large-scale projects, you need that kind of collaboration, that it's hard for the public sector or the private sector to do it alone. And there's expertise in both organizations that allow you to do something bigger than you could on your own, or on the public's own, or on the private sector's own.
So if we could talk about the World Trade Center and your actual role there. So you're working, obviously, with, there are developers that own the site, and then there's government interest.
Oh gosh, it's complicated. So there is the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey, so it's a bi-state agency, owned the site on September 11th. But Larry Silverstein, Silverstein Properties, had a 99-year lease on the development, which then made it automatically kind of a public and a private enterprise. Of course, given the enormity of the tragedy and the complexity of just getting it done in New York, there are obviously governors from both states who are involved, the mayor, traffic. I think one of the most important things were the citizens themselves. It was one of the first times in my lifetime where the people of New York and probably the world wanted to have an input into what happened there because it meant so much to everybody. And of course, the victims' families were also incredibly important in the process, that, you know, neither public nor private, but the spiritual kind of driver for the whole project. So, you know, we had a lot of complex challenges. It would have been complex building 16 million square feet on 16 acres in New York City, no matter what you do. But we have PATH trains running underneath. You have the security issues you can imagine just building that project in New York. But having all those people around the table that didn't always agree, I think ended up with something that would have been much better than had one entity done it on its own, right? That sincere commitment to the project, and everybody around the table, no matter what their position was, felt humbled by the challenge and cared deeply about the result. And I think those kind of projects are the ones that can change communities, cities, you know, have a really large impact. And you learn that listening to other people, collaborating with different entities, agencies, communities, most importantly, then you can have a really large impact.
Did you find that the aims or the goals of the private sector versus the community were quite different, and how were they managed?
So I think there, obviously the private interest is going to have its mission about being profitable, but the community is going to have its interest for how, I think the way we saw it in that way was, we knew we could develop nice commercial buildings for New York City, right? That's something we know how to do. But how do we create a great public space for Lower Manhattan, and how do you memorialize what had happened? And I think in the end, if you can balance those items and hear what every side is saying, you can kind of answer all the questions. And we always thought about it from the point of view of not of the people who might be in the towers, but of course the victims' families first. But what would it be like for Daniel's parents, who were immigrants that came from Poland through Israel, that weren't going to be working in these towers? What is the experience for this project for them? They'll be using the public transportation, they'll be using the public space. So we really became advocates of the public realm of the project more than anything, which I think benefits the private development. I think that's what we all know in the projects that we work on. The better they are for communities, the more successful they are commercially, and vice versa, right? The better commercially successful are, the better the communities are that we live in. So when people remove the borders and kind of care deeply about the end goal, that's when that's the ideal in the situation. So it's unfortunate, I think, sometimes in other projects around the world, where without the enormity of the mission that we had, if we all still cared that much about what we were doing to the built environment and how we were impacting communities, and spent the time respectfully listening to each other, arguing about the things that we care about for the result of the place that you're building, there could be a lot of successful development.
Monocle's Nick Manise there, speaking with Carla Swickerath. Well, we enjoyed hosting three important voices in the world of city building, and it's good to see there's a little tension in their visions. It's this push and pull between disciplines that creates healthy debate, and in turn, a richer conversation leads to more tested outcomes. And with development sites at a premium, we just don't have the space or the time to invest in projects that fail cities. So here's to more strident debate and better outcomes and better places to live, play and work in. Well, that's all for this week's episode of The Urbanist. Today's show was produced by Carlotta Ribello. It was researched by Nick Manise, and it was edited by David Stevens. Our thanks to Stacey Anderson at the Van Allen Institute too. And to play you out of this episode of The Urbanist, here's Arno Rebatoni with Housing Committee. Thank you for listening, City Lovers.